Dee came to me and said they thought it was time to make the statement. Our diplomats thought it could lead to the closure of the embassy, but we were on that path anyway. Clinton supported it, and the Treasury Department had a stronger package of sanctions ready to go. Obama said he was open to doing so, provided that we acted in concert with our allies. A diplomatic strategy was prepared to maximize Assad's isolation. I drafted a statement in Obama's name, which included these sentences. We have consistently said that President Assad must lead a democratic transition or get out of the way. He has not led. For the sake of the Syrian people, the time has come for President Assad to step aside. On the morning of August 18th, I emailed Obama to make sure he was good with the text of the statement, and he replied yes. And so it was sent out to the world, with Cameron, Sarkozy, and Merkel issuing their own joint statement echoing Obama and saying Assad should face the reality of the complete rejection of his regime by the Syrian people. Looking back, while the focus has always been on whether we should have taken military action, I am haunted by the question of whether some more assertive diplomatic initiative could have avoided some of the violence to come, even if it didn't require Assad's immediate ouster. We were counting on the building pressure on Assad from within to be met with growing isolation from abroad in a way that would cause his regime to crumble. Meetings were held to plan for what would happen after he left power. Openings pursued to test whether he would leave peacefully. Evaluations done on which figures within his government could participate in a transition. Whereas U.S. government assessments had downplayed the potential for Mubarak to step down before February 2011, they now veered in the other direction, anticipating Assad's ouster. Most analysts seemed to think his days were numbered, and so did I. Yet I detected a greater degree of skepticism from Obama, who cautioned us, Syria could be a longer slog than we think. He was, I think, turning over in his head the point he'd posed to me in the limo ride back from his speech on Libya. Whether we had enough bandwidth to shape the Arab Spring. Later, I would come to see he was also debating something else. Whether it was shapeable at all. In late August, while Obama was on vacation on Martha's Vineyard, I went up to New York City. I needed a quiet few days, a chance to get away by myself and visit old friends before flying out to California to meet Anne and her parents. Every time I arrive in the city, emerging from the escalators at Penn Station, I feel a release as soon as I disappear into the crowd. Some people relax in the country or on the beach. For me, it is a crowded subway car or a cramped Chinatown street. I walked for miles, emptying my head, looking at the Freedom Tower going up, sun beating off the glass, cranes bent in the sky. I checked my phone and noticed social media reports of Libyan rebels closing in on Tripoli. Sitting in Battery Park, I started getting emails from young staffers at the NSC and state, people who knew which social media accounts to follow. This is how the White House learned that Tripoli was about to fall. On Twitter. It had been 5 months since the first American bombs fell over Libya. Without putting a single soldier on the ground or suffering a single American casualty, we'd helped save thousands of lives, and now Gaddafi's government was collapsing. It felt as though maybe, just maybe, the tide was turning against the strong men of the Middle East. A friend of mine on the NSC sent me her favorite Gandhi quote. In the end, tyrants fall. Think of it. Always. It seemed possible to believe that. A few weeks later, Gaddafi was killed in his hometown of Sirte. A coalition drone struck his convoy. Gaddafi fled the vehicle and tried to hide in a drainpipe. A group of rebels dragged him out and killed him. It was an apt metaphor for the entire war. Us in the air, Libyans on the ground. As Brennan told me, a fitting end for one of the biggest rats of the 20th century. That fall also saw the end of Obama's first-term push for Middle East peace. Every September, we would head up to New York for a few days at the United Nations General Assembly, UNGA, where the world descended for an intense period of diplomacy. Life at UNGA revolved around the Waldorf Astoria, a grand old hotel on Park Avenue that seemed to revel in the fact that its best days were in the past. The hallway carpets slightly stained and faded, the walls filled with black and white photos of celebrities hanging out with one another in the 1950s, portraits of Harry Truman and Dwight Eisenhower. Every year around UNGA, the hotel would fill with diplomats, African and Middle Eastern delegations, journalists, spies, and a gigantic American contingent. The whole thing was tinged with nostalgia, including for another time in American foreign policy, the post-World War II years when the world came to us. The first night at UNGA, Obama and his top advisors always met in the penthouse suite at the Waldorf, which doubled as the residence for the American ambassador to the United Nations. Susan Rice had taken well to the job. She has a mind that can wrap itself around minutiae. And she had mastered the intricacies of the UN, how to navigate the various bureaucracies and procedures, how to craft a resolution, how to cajole votes. Her direct manner served her well in an environment that values strong personalities, and her relationship with Obama gave her that intangible asset that foreign governments value most, closeness to the president. We'd done some of our biggest business through Security Council resolutions on Iran's sanctions and Libya, and she'd delivered. The position of UN ambassador is one of the stepping stones to Secretary of State, and Susan was in a strong position if Obama was reelected. Susan had also stayed in close touch with me, reviewing drafts of speeches, popping in to see me when she was in the West Wing, greeting me with a hug and slap on the back. Alone among people of cabinet rank, she'd taken the same forward-leaning positions as Samantha and me on Egypt and Libya. If she couldn't quite read what was going on at the White House, she'd give me a call. If she thought I said something stupid, she'd respond with a bemused, "What you talking about, Willis?" There was a sense that those of us who had gone through the campaign together were family and, implicitly, had one another's backs. She had altered the stodgy feel of the penthouse by hanging large canvases of modern art, and as we sunk into well-worn chairs and couches, a waiter served drinks and hors d'oeuvres. Susan painted a grim picture on Middle East peace. We were working to secure a majority of votes on the Security Council against recognizing the Palestinians. That way, they would be less likely to force the issue to a vote. With everything else going on in the world, we had a play to run to ensure we won Gabon's vote to block Palestinian statehood. I found the whole thing depressing. We weren't doing anything other than averting even worse outcomes. This became clear in our meetings with foreign leaders, who all seemed to be playing roles in a drama that they knew would end in the same way, with the United States blocking the Palestinians at the United Nations, Israel isolated, the Palestinians frustrated. In a meeting with Recep Tayyip Erdogan, the Turkish Prime Minister, Erdogan read back the words from Obama's speech at the previous year's UNGA with a thin smile, imploring everyone to work for the goal of being back at the UNGA the following year with a peace deal, one that could welcome Palestine to the General Assembly. Obama and Erdogan had formed a working relationship, albeit one that took up a lot of time. Erdogan liked to debate matters at length. With each passing year, he grew more stubborn. As he consolidated power at home, he seemed less accustomed to dissent of any kind. Obama argued that it was untenable for the Palestinians to achieve statehood at the UN. It had to be negotiated with Israel. "Look at South Sudan," he said. "It took many years and a negotiated settlement for the world's newest country to be born." "And it took years of sanctions on the North," Erdogan shot back. "Are you suggesting the same for Israel?" After the meeting, Obama called me up to his suite to go over the speech he would give to the UNGA the next morning. We went through edits, and then he paused on the Middle East section, in which we were fully embracing Israel's position. "I hate it when Erdogan has arguments to make," he said. "The Sudan one was pretty good," I said. "The thing is," Obama said, "I really don't think the Palestinians should go to the UN. I just can't make Beebe want peace. Have you seen Jerry Maguire? I asked. Of course, he answered. Dealing with Netanyahu is like that, I said. Help me help you. Obama laughed. It would become something we'd repeat over the years when Beebe inevitably rejected any effort at peace. I stayed up until 2 finishing the speech, toughening the language to make it stronger in support of Israel. I had no problem summoning the words to defend Israel in front of a group of delegates that included a lot of hypocrites and outright anti-Semites. The Palestinians did need to achieve statehood through a negotiation with Israel, but it was also obvious that Netanyahu wasn't going to negotiate seriously. After the speech, I wandered back to the Waldorf for Obama's meeting with Sarkozy, who had surprised us that morning by declaring his support for Palestinian recognition by the General Assembly. Obama was annoyed. We are not usually surprised like that by allies on such a sensitive matter. Sarkozy breezed into the conference room, followed by his entourage, a short, elegantly dressed man in constant motion, and sat down next to Obama. The press came in, and Sarkozy lavished praise on Obama. As soon as they were gone, Obama got serious. Nicolas, he said, you've got to give us a heads up on things. Sarkozy cut him off. Barak, he said, you are absolutely right. Let me tell you why I did what I did. I despise this man, Netanyahu. He humiliated you in the Oval Office. He lied to me. He went on and on, grabbing his lapels, pounding the table for emphasis. Obama smiled throughout and tried to lighten the mood. Nicolas, he said, I've already got my Nobel Prize. I'd be happy to see you get yours. Our last meeting of the day was with Mahmoud Abbas, the Palestinian president. They met alone, with only one staffer for each side, so I stood waiting in the hallway outside the room. When the door opened, I saw Obama guiding Abbas by the elbow out of the room. An older man, slow and deliberate in his movements, he shook Obama's hand and left to walk down the hall. He looked deflated, a man playing a role leading nowhere, buffeted by forces stronger than himself from all around. Israel, the United States, the Arab states. I had no way of knowing whether he truly wanted to make peace, but I knew that he was finding little more than rhetorical support from us. Obama signaled for me to come in and eat dinner with him. His usual plate of salmon, brown rice, and steamed broccoli. The simplicity of his meals always said something about his discipline. Food was something that sustained his health and energy in this job, not something to be enjoyed. How do you want me to read this meeting out? I asked. Here's how you should read it out, he said. I've decided to be a one-term president. I'm going to support the Palestinian bid at the United Nations. He was tweaking me, knowing that I was disappointed at where things had ended up, but also knowing that I had no better ideas. He was unable to push Israel to stop its settlement of Palestinian land, and despite Netanyahu's intransigence, he would always side with Israel when push came to shove. It felt as though the Israeli-Palestinian conflict was something we had to manage, not solve, keep the two sides talking, persuade the Palestinians not to give up on the prospect of a state altogether, block the United Nations from piling on Israel. Reaction, not action. As we struggled to keep a lid on the various crises boiling over across the Middle East, where autocracy, tribalism, and sectarianism seemed more powerful than any external force, even the United States of America, I looked for other regions and issues to devote my time to, places where we could do something affirmative in the world. That November, we were scheduled to go to Asia. A few weeks before we left, Jake Sullivan, Kurt Campbell, and Danny Russell asked to meet me at the White House. Jake was Hillary's deputy chief of staff and director of policy planning. In reality, he did a little bit of everything and did it better than anyone else. He was my age, a Minnesotan with straight, parted, sandy brown hair, who had followed the kind of career arc that leads to the top of America's foreign policy establishment. Impeccable academic credentials, Supreme Court clerk, top aide on Hillary's presidential campaign. Kurt was the Assistant Secretary of State, a large man with a larger personality. He was equally passionate about grand strategy and a quixotic personal quest to find the remains of Amelia Earhart. Danny was more understated, a Foreign Service officer who had spent decades immersed in the intricacies of Asian politics and had been elevated to the job of top Asia staffer at the White House by a president who shared his personal affinity for the region. They pitched me an idea. The time was right to pursue an opening with Burma. For nearly 50 years, it had been ruled by a reclusive military junta. Like many Americans, my awareness of Burma was through the story of Aung San Suu Kyi, the Nobel Peace Prize-winning daughter of Burma's independence hero who had been imprisoned, largely in her own home, for most of 2 decades after she swept to victory in a 1990 election. By the fall of 2011, there were signs that things were changing. The military had adopted a new constitution that transitioned to a civilian-led government. Suu Kyi had been released from house arrest and was re-entering politics. They suggested that Obama should use his Asia trip to announce that we would re-engage the Burmese government and that Hillary would visit the country. I agreed to do what I could to get this done. For the last 2 years, we had worked to elevate the importance of the Asia-Pacific region. Many of the issues that motivated Obama, growing the American economy, combating climate change, forging new rules to govern trade and commerce among nations, depended upon cooperation in Asia. While the Middle East represented the past, its religious wars, American-backed autocrats, Iranian revolutionaries, terrorist threats, Asia seemed to represent the future. It helped that the people and governments in Asia wanted to deepen relations with the United States, in part because of their concerns about the largest emerging power in their neighborhood, China. Our November trip would be pivotal, shaping our Asia policy for the rest of the administration. We started in Hawaii, where the United States would be hosting APEC, a summit of Pacific countries. We spent 2 days there, signaling a tougher stance on China and a more assertive posture in Asia. With a nod from Obama, we took the ongoing negotiations over a trade agreement with a large bloc of Pacific nations, the Trans-Pacific Partnership, or TPP, and played it up as the centerpiece of our broader regional strategy, one in which the United States, and not China, would write the rules of international trade. We were preparing to announce a deployment of Marines to a new base in Australia, and we finalized plans for Obama to call Aung San Suu Kyi and make his announcement that we were opening up relations with Burma. On our last night there, Tom Donilon, Jay Carney, and I got a message that Obama wanted to have a drink. That was unusual. Obama usually passed his nights playing cards or doing work. We went up to his suite, which had a huge deck overlooking the Pacific, and settled in while Obama explained that he wanted us to see the view. He switched from mindless banter to contemplative conversation while a valet brought us drinks and bowls of snacks. "You know," he said, "everything is just better in Hawaii." "It helps that there are no snakes," I said, a piece of trivia I had learned. "We have a lot of mongoose for that purpose," he said, once again fulfilling his role as the guy with an answer for everything. Then he started talking about Asia more broadly, the mix of cultures, religions, and races he found so familiar. "Hawaii has a lot in common with Jakarta," he said. "There's a certain communal spirit. Americans are more individualistic." He sipped his drink and looked out at the endless ocean. "When you spend time growing up in Jakarta like I did, and see the masses of humanity in a place like that, it makes it harder for you to think purely of yourself." We sat there in a moment of pregnant silence, and I tried to imagine what it was like to grow up on crowded Indonesian streets in the 1960s. Then Obama started to complain that people in Washington liked to say that he was aloof. "Few things irritate me more," he said, mimicking the line of criticism. "He's aloof. He doesn't have friends." That could not be more wrong. I'm almost always around people. I just have a different group of friends than people who've been running for office since they were 22. Donilon pointed out that people like Clinton and Bush had been coming to Washington long before they ran for president. But Obama didn't want to dwell on other presidents. "The thing is," he said, "I was a fully formed person before I went into politics. And I didn't have any money until my book started to sell after the 2004 convention. It took me 12 years to sell 14,000 books." Obama recalled how he'd finished Dreams from My Father in Bali, writing in longhand because it helped him think. "I looked around at this terrace, with its endless view of the Pacific, and it occurred to me how far away this suite was from some backpacking destination in Bali. This part of the world which had shaped Obama was going to be more important to the future than the familiar battlefields of the Middle East, but it was distant from the debates that dominated in Washington." "This really is a great view," he said. Obama got up to go to bed, and I walked down a flight of stairs to my room. It was my 35th birthday. After a stop in Australia, we flew to Bali for the East Asia Summit, the first time that the United States attended this forum for Asian nations, a signal of our increased focus on the region. On the flight, Obama called Aung San Suu Kyi. With her agreement, he would announce that we'd be opening engagement with the Burmese government and sending Hillary Clinton to visit. I sat opposite him, listening in as they talked. They discussed the trends in Burma, with Suu Kyi running through a list of issues, the democratic reform process, the release of political prisoners, the process of reconciling with over a dozen ethnic armed groups in the country. She spoke more as a politician than an icon of democracy, referencing her outreach to the military that imprisoned her all those years. "We want them to understand that we will work with them if they work with us," she said. "The United States should be very clear in talking to them about rewards, not punishments." "We don't need to be talking about punishments. They know all about punishments." Obama told her that he was going to announce the visit from Hillary. Suu Kyi agreed, and then spoke about the need to reconcile the warring ethnic groups in the country. "I hope you can come to Burma yourself before too long," she said. "We have many admirers of you here. Many NLD wear T-shirts with you on them," she said, referring to her political party. In Bali, we stayed at a hotel with balconies that looked out on a pond full of giant lizards. We met up with Hillary, who was joining us for the summit. Our press was always eager to get access to her, and she agreed to do a series of interviews, but lamented the fact that they would likely focus more on her own political future than the issues she'd been working on. "How many questions do you think I'll get on Asia?" she said. "Maybe one?" So far, the trip had gone exactly as planned. We'd signaled a pivot to the Asia-Pacific nations, with large commercial sales and TPP representing our economic strategy. The deployment of Marines to Australia representing a deepening security commitment, and the opening to Burma representing a commitment to promote democracy and expand relations in Southeast Asia. It was widely and rightly interpreted as a challenge to China. The last night of the trip was the gala dinner for the East Asia Summit. We sat in a cavernous convention center. There were 3 hours of entertainment, a Filipino girl band singing pop standards such as Fly Me to the Moon. A large video screen showed statistics about Southeast Asian countries on a loop, their GDP, their population growth. Then the MC improbably invited Quincy Jones to the stage. He lumbered up from some corner of the room, talked about being asked to do this the night before, and mentioned having just come from Morocco, where he'd produced an album called Voices of the Arab Spring for the King. Like us, Quincy was making his own pivot to Asia. Then he announced that he was going to sing We Are the World and invited my President Obama and Premier Nguyen to come up on stage to sing with him, hands clasped. I stopped chewing ice. Jay Carney and I began to launch from our chairs, prepared to use physical violence, if necessary, to stop this photo op from taking place heading into an election year. But before we had to do anything, Obama was waving Quincy down from his seat. Nguyen sat frozen in his chair, A large group of children joined Quincy on stage instead. There comes a time when we heed a certain call. Advance staff asked us to load the motorcade since the dinner was ending and the U.S. president leaves first, which led to the unfortunate visual of the entire U.S. delegation walking out to We Are the World. Back at the hotel, Obama called me to the villa where he was staying. Standing there in the giant batik shirt that leaders had been made to wear, he complained about getting jammed with another China meeting the next day. How many times do I need to tell you that I'm getting overscheduled on these trips? At least you didn't have to sing with the guy, I said. Obama laughed. SBY definitely paid Quincy to be there, he said, referring to the president of Indonesia. Not as much as the king of Morocco, I said. All right, that's good. Get out of here, he said. That night, I sat staring at the lizards off my balcony. I thought about Obama. He was like a subject I'd studied for years, reading his books, analyzing his comments, internalizing his speech edits, channeling his worldview into written words and policy. But still, I wrestled with the constant concern that I was losing myself inside the experience, transformed into a cipher for the needs of this other person who, after all, was a politician, playing the role of U.S. president. There is always something sad about the last night of these trips. They consume you for weeks. They move you around, without sleep, for days. You stay in beautiful places, see strange things, meet famous people, and develop an intense camaraderie with the people you are with. But I felt like it was impossible to explain these things to people back home. My wife, my parents, my old friends. It was like you inhabited two parallel lives, one that made you who you were, and the other that was consuming that person and transforming you into someone else. Chapter 14. Life, Death, and Benghazi. The days pass, passing trips, passing crises, passing ceremonies, meetings that bleed into one another, windowless rooms, lunch from the carry-out window on the ground floor of the West Wing, guarded by dozens of Secret Service officers at a variety of outposts, snipers watching from on top of the White House, looking out at the perimeter gates ringing the complex and the tourists, D.C. residents, the occasional protester or crazy person who wants to stand as close as they can to this nerve center for the application of power in the world, all of it running on an endless loop. There is always a relentless flow of information. Intelligence reports, casualty reports, notifications of natural disasters, and economic data finding their way to the right people in the right offices. Reports that offer bits of information about billions of individual lives, about the manner in which things might or might not be changing. The days are long, the weeks are long, the months are long, but the years are short. One day you look up and realize you're on the precipice of the final year of a presidential term. You see the world in a different way, as if you could open a window and catch a glimpse of anything that is touched by the reach of the United States government. You can be a part of actions that shape these events. Your voice in a meeting, your intervention on a budget line item, your role in crafting the words that a president speaks. You are also a bystander to crises that elude intervention, buffeted by the constant and contradictory demands made on an American president, by other American politicians, by the media, by advocacy organizations, by people around the world. You never know what is the one meeting, the one decision, the one word or phrase that will matter. On December 18th, 2011, one large piece of business was finally completed as the last convoy of U.S. troops left Iraq. Ironically, the timing had been determined by an agreement between the Bush administration and the Iraqi government, reached shortly before Obama took office. For many months, Obama considered leaving a small presence of troops there, and even signed off on a force of 10,000 that would continue to train Iraqi security forces. But this was predicated on the Iraqi government's agreeing to give American troops immunity from criminal prosecution, something America demands for our troops around the world, and that seemed particularly necessary in the unpredictable currents of Iraqi politics. The Iraqi government, conscious of its sovereignty, refused. So on October 21st, Obama held a video conference with the Prime Minister of Iraq, Nouri al-Maliki. The two leaders determined that the removal of U.S. troops would be completed on schedule. Ending a war in which there is no clear victory is an anticlimactic thing. The flag-draped coffins and funerals were over, as was the $10 billion a month price tag. But by the time we finished pulling out, the focus on Iraq had faded. It was a marker of a different era, the defining event of a different presidency. The only thing that wouldn't fade was the effort to shape the perception of what had happened there. For years to come, the war's supporters would blame the further tragedies that would take place in Iraq on the fact that we didn't keep those 10,000 troops there, rather than on the decision to invade the country in the first place. What does it mean to invade a country, topple its leader, face a raging insurgency, open a Pandora's box of sectarian conflict across a region, spend trillions of dollars, kill hundreds of thousands of people, and permanently alter hundreds of thousands of American lives? Something in the character of post-9/11 America seemed unable or unwilling to process the scale of the catastrophic decision and the spillover effects it had, an emboldened Iran, embattled Gulf states, a Syrian dictator who didn't want to be next, a Russian strongman who resented American dominance, a terrorist organization that would turn itself into an Islamic state, and all the individual human beings caught in between. I went to California for Christmas. My father-in-law, Roger Norris, had recently been diagnosed with stage 4 lung cancer, a private tragedy amid the global ones that consumed most of my days. It was unlikely, the doctors said, that he would live more than a year. Roger was a quiet man. Born in Ohio, raised in Michigan, he made his way to California and worked his whole life as an engineer, first for Douglas Aircraft, which then became part of McDonnell Douglas, which then became part of Boeing. He helped to build the airplanes and spacecraft that became the ballast of America's post-war power. He raised 7 kids and settled in Huntington Beach with its wide beaches, 2-car garages, and good public schools. On my first trips to Huntington Beach, I'd felt out of place, a New Yorker wandering the few sidewalks, searching in vain for a New York Times. The household was always bustling, but it could be a raucous place. Roger was an island of calm, tinkering at some project outside in the garage, reading the LA Times, lending money to his children when they needed it. He allowed himself few indulgences. On one of his visits, I took him to a baseball game, and as we ordered a third beer, he told me he hadn't had a few beers at the ballpark in decades. After his diagnosis, we began a project of checking things off his bucket list. His interests seemed frozen in the 1950s, like the photographs on the walls of the Waldorf. We saw Bing Crosby's White Christmas and ate New Year's dinner at Lowry's, a classic Beverly Hills prime rib joint. We went to New York and saw Jersey Boys on Broadway. Anne, the family organizer, planned additional trips to Santa Barbara and Hawaii. She idolized her father, who had been the one who took her to book fairs and talked politics against the backdrop of Huntington Beach's surfing culture. With a death approaching, I watched as the wider world shrinks to a family circle and ultimately becomes inconsequential. Yet my time was limited, the pull of pressing events never farther away than my BlackBerry. My own experience was improbable and exciting to the people around me, people like my father, the son of an engineer from Baytown, Texas, or Roger Norris, an engineer from Michigan, who had gotten in his car and driven west. At the same time, the things my job offered seemed symbolically important, but impersonal. Prominently displayed in the Norris household was a picture of Barack Obama with Anne at a state dinner, with the president's inscription, "To Roger, thanks for doing such a great job with Anne." I represented how far Anne had come from Roger's simple Michigan roots, but it was always hard for me to explain what I did, something more easily captured in that framed photograph. For big chunks of 2012, I'd be alone in D.C. while Anne took leaves of absence to be with her family out in California. At the White House, the world continued to spin on its axis, even as the re-election campaign started to envelop all that we did. You had to do the things that were in front of you without knowing whether you would be around to see where the story would go. In the early months of 2012, there was real concern that there was going to be a war between Israel and Iran. The Iranian nuclear program continued to advance. The threats out of Israel were becoming more bellicose, and there were signs that a strike on Iran's nuclear facilities could be imminent. A steady stream of U.S. officials traveled to Jerusalem to counsel against an attack. In the White House, we prepared for scenarios in which a strike took place and the United States was drawn into a wider regional war with Iran, a country much larger, more sophisticated, and more powerful than Saddam Hussein's Iraq. To obtain leverage on Iran, we were steadily expanding sanctions. This required the cooperation of other countries, which needed to help us reduce the revenue that Iran could get from selling oil. Throughout 2011 and 2012, in meetings with China, Japan, South Korea, India, and European countries, Iran's sanctions topped the agenda as Obama convinced leaders to do something against their own economic interest. But still, Netanyahu complained he wasn't doing enough. When Netanyahu visited Washington to address AIPAC in early March, I spent several days leading a public campaign to make the case that there was time. Time to let tougher sanctions sink in. Time to test whether diplomacy could make a difference. We prepared a set of talking points that rebutted the arguments for war. We had meetings with groups of prominent columnists and journalists to make our case. We held briefings for members of Congress who were nervous about being out of step with Israel. Obama sat down for a lengthy interview in which he made it clear that he would strike Iran's nuclear facilities if he thought it necessary to do so, but that we were not yet at that point. He gave a speech restating those positions, and he said the same things to Netanyahu in private. At some point that spring, Netanyahu blinked, and we were spared the consequences of another war. But on many issues, it felt as if the looming election sidelined more ambitious foreign policy initiatives, that politics was crowding out any capacity for risk. I worried that we were becoming so conservative that we were losing touch with what we had set out to do. We had done a lengthy review of the cuts that we could make to the U.S. nuclear arsenal after the conclusion of the new START treaty, a key pillar of the affirmative agenda that Obama announced in Prague. We settled for the most modest option. On Egypt, I'd grown frustrated at how our government had largely reverted to deference to the Egyptian military, which was playing a double game, mouthing words of support for democracy while taking steps to undermine civil society at home. I'd raise this, but Obama would lose patience. Our priority has to be stability and supporting the SCAF, Egyptian Military Council, he snapped at me. Even if we get criticized, I'm not interested in the crowd in Tahrir Square and Nick Kristof, he said, referring to a columnist who'd been critical of our Egypt policy. He rationalized this because the military had to ensure that elections took place, but he also seemed to be talking himself into the rightness of more incremental change. Burdened by a re-election campaign, buffeted by the stridency of his opposition at home, divisions among his own team, and a sense that he lacked good partners abroad, Obama seemed at times to be using his powerful mind to find justifications for more modest ambitions. Another time, at a meeting on what he was aiming to accomplish in his first term, I pointed to the potential for a democratic opening in Burma. "Ben," he said, "no one cares about Burma in Ohio." These comments stuck with me. For the first time, I felt out of step with my boss. In the quiet of my empty apartment, I began to wrestle with bigger questions. How would I see myself in 5 years if I couldn't remember what I was like 5 years ago? How do you establish your own voice when your entire reputation is founded on someone else's? How much can you compromise your own positions in service of a larger good before you sacrifice them? I felt we had gradually trimmed our sails and lowered our sights, a year after the heady days of the Libya intervention and Bin Laden operation. It felt as if we were becoming technocratic, competent managers of things amid a world roiling with change. Drone strikes to take out terrorists, reducing the population at Gitmo but unable to close it, averting a war with Iran while imposing sanctions. I was advocating proposals that weren't expedient or politically popular. More pressure on the Egyptian military, more action in Syria, more time spent on places like Burma. And yet I also saw how little those issues mattered in the campaign that was taking place. We needed to designate one White House official who worked on national security to be able to coordinate with the re-election campaign on messaging. I was the only option. I'd been responsible for the public messaging around Obama's national security policies for 5 years. I'd have to shift from being an employee of the NSC to an employee of the White House, a small bureaucratic move that seemed designed to protect those institutions more than me. I looked increasingly for smaller things that I could work on. If I had outlets on issues where I could make a difference, it could add a layer to my experience at work separate from the grind of politics and the intractability of some of the larger issues on our agenda. One issue was education in Libya. With the country struggling to put itself back together, there were plans for the United States to help Libyans restore a system of higher education. Late that spring, I met with our ambassador, Chris Stevens, who had served in Benghazi throughout the revolution. He had a reputation for being the kind of envoy who worked with people as well as governments, knowing the language, the food, the culture of the place he was posted. He had a calm demeanor, sandy brown hair, and an easy smile. "We already have the attention of the government on this, and we need areas where we can cooperate," he said. "It'd be great if you could give this a push out of here." We talked about where to find money in the budget, what partners to enlist, how this fit into the broader picture of our Libya policy. "I think we can get the diaspora involved in this," I said, referring to a number of the Libyans I'd met. "They already are," Stevens said. A number had returned to the country. As we wrapped up, I said, "I'd like to visit." "That would be great," he said. I thought I'd go sometime after the election. That August, my father-in-law took a turn for the worse, and I flew out to California again. When I arrived, he had just come home from the hospital. He was frail, his body weakening, as he hadn't been responding to treatment and couldn't really eat. He thanked me for coming, as if it was an inconvenience. The next day, he slipped into a different place, unable to speak, and a 24-hour hospice nurse was dispatched to the house. Anne and I slept upstairs in the room where she lived as a child as her father lay dying in the living room downstairs. People took turns saying goodbye. Anne's 12-year-old niece, Emma, played the piano. She had become the center of Roger's life. He died 2 days later, surrounded by family, in the house where he raised 7 children. Making myself useful, I took Emma to In-N-Out Burger. In the blur of days that followed, funeral arrangements were made, stories were told, friends of Roger's came and went. He was the type of person who had quietly made a larger impact on people's lives than anyone knew. In the days leading up to the funeral, we went through some of Roger's old things, the small amount of stuff that he'd saved or put aside. I found a folder stashed away in the closet filled with newspaper clippings that traced some key moments in my career, an article in the Los Angeles Times about my role in the Cairo speech, yellowing just a bit around the edges, a flattering piece about the young group of Obama White House aides trying to find a different way to communicate with the Muslim world. He had never told anyone about this habit of his, nor asked me much about my work. Whenever it came up, he seemed to keep a respectful distance, not wanting to probe. I tried to picture him, alone with the scissors, cutting up his morning paper with an engineer's precision and putting the clippings away neatly in the closet to be found later, at another time, by another person. On the afternoon of Tuesday, September 11th, 2012, we started to get alarming reports out of Cairo. Hundreds of chanting protesters had gathered at the walls of our embassy. Apparently, a video entitled Innocence of Muslims, a crude and seemingly obscure movie intended to humiliate the Prophet Muhammad, had generated this backlash. A 14-minute trailer had been posted on YouTube earlier in the summer. An Egyptian Coptic Christian who lived in California was promoting the video, and it started to get picked up in Egypt. Part of it was then dubbed into Arabic, and a short segment was shown on Egyptian TV. Islamist clerics condemned the movie, fueling a sense of grievance that brought thousands of Egyptians into the streets. The immediate concern was security at our embassy. In an effort to calm the protests, our embassy spokesman had put out a statement saying, "The Embassy of the United States in Cairo condemns the continuing efforts by misguided individuals to hurt the religious feelings of Muslims." I sat at my desk watching the video, a low-budget internet movie that portrayed Muhammad as a decadent character, the protagonist in a knockoff of bad late-night Cinemax. Meanwhile, as the day turned into evening in Cairo, the crowd scaled the walls of our compound and raised a black flag used by militants across the Middle East with an insignia that read, in Arabic, "There is no God but God, and Muhammad is his prophet." I spent much of the afternoon in meetings about what needed to be done to secure our embassy and staunch the swelling uproar. Late in the afternoon, as I sat in Dennis McDonough's office recapping our public messaging plan, I learned that the crisis wasn't limited to Cairo. Something had also happened at our diplomatic compound in Benghazi. In a meeting with his Secretary of Defense, Obama had directed that the military do what was necessary to secure U.S. facilities in Libya and across the region. There was a sense of crisis escalating. Unlike Cairo, there was not a large contingent of American journalists in Benghazi, so there were no TV cameras and little reliable information about what was happening. Information trickled in. Chris Stevens was apparently at the compound when it came under attack, and he was unaccounted for. I thought about the man who had just recently sat in my office, earnestly discussing how to improve higher education in Libya, and hoped he wasn't hurt. At one point, there was a positive report. Stevens' cell phone had called a senior State Department official. But over the course of the evening, the reports grew darker. The call had been placed from a hospital. Stevens was badly injured. And then, as evening settled in Washington, the word came. Stevens was dead. Another American was also reportedly killed. Suddenly, we were faced with this terrible news, the thing you fear the most, the death of Americans overseas. I sat in my office, feeling numb, remembering when the genial, dogged, and optimistic Stevens had sat, full of life, across from my desk a few months ago. It is a reality of 21st century communications that you have to address totally different audiences at the same time, because anything you say will be consumed by the entire world. We now had several pressing communications challenges. First, the United States government had to confirm the death of Chris Stevens and another American, a 34-year-old named Sean Smith, to condemn the violence that killed them, and to mourn their loss. Second, U.S. embassies in the Middle East, worried about further protests, were asking for statements that distanced the U.S. government from this video and condemned its attacks on the Prophet Muhammad. Third, we needed to deal with a right-wing American media that had already started to attack the statement put out by the U.S. Embassy in Cairo for blaming the violence on the video rather than the protesters. Given that an ambassador had been killed and diplomatic facilities were under assault, our initial statement would come from Clinton. Jake Sullivan took the lead on it, and I reviewed different drafts and signed off for the White House. The language was straightforward. I condemn in the strongest terms the attack on our mission in Benghazi. We are heartbroken by this terrible loss. Later in the statement, we addressed the concerns expressed by our embassies overseas without suggesting that any violence was justified. The United States deplores any intentional effort to denigrate the religious beliefs of others, but let me be clear. There is never any justification for violent acts of this kind. More than 3 years later, I'd have to go over the language of this statement in careful detail before a congressional committee. I stayed at work until there was nothing left to do. Around 9 or 10, I walked home, feeling a mix of sadness and anger. Egypt and Libya, the two places that a year ago had represented so much hope, were now roiling with protests by people who had nothing to offer except hate. Two Americans were dead. When I got home, I poured a large glass of scotch and opened up my laptop to see if there was any other news. Around midnight, I saw a statement that had been put out by Mitt Romney. It's disgraceful that the Obama administration's first response was not to condemn the attacks on our diplomatic missions, but to sympathize with those who waged the attacks. I stood in my bedroom processing the words as waves of anger washed over me. For a moment, I couldn't even understand which statement Romney meant. Then I realized that he was referring to the statement that the embassy in Cairo put out earlier in the day, before anything had happened in Benghazi. I had grown accustomed to ugly Republican attacks, but this felt different. Some threshold had been crossed. They were slamming us in the crudest possible way in the middle of a crisis. They were attacking career Foreign Service people who had issued a statement while their embassy was under siege. They were ignoring the fact that the video was offensive. They were making it harder for us to say things that could help protect American lives abroad. They would say anything if it could cast Obama as somehow anti-American. It wasn't just politics. It was sickening in its cynicism. We were now in some new, uglier reality. I could never have guessed just how ugly it would become. That for the next 4 years, Benghazi would be transformed from the name of a city in Libya where American intervention had saved tens of thousands of lives into something entirely different. A word that represented the sentiment in that statement of Romney's, an expression of an ugly conspiracy theory to delegitimize Obama and Clinton, destroy any concern for facts that didn't fit the theory, and dehumanize a small group of people, including me. Benghazi. The next morning, I woke in the pre-dawn hours to learn that two more Americans had been killed overnight in some kind of firefight. The details were sparse. I got to the White House early, where there was a meeting to review security measures for our embassies across the Middle East. I locked myself in my office to write a statement that Obama would give just a couple of hours later in the Rose Garden, working off situation reports from the State Department and some limited biographical information on the men who died, and suggesting language to distance ourselves from the video. I wrote many statements like this, locked in my office with the door closed, acutely aware that a lot of people, including the President of the United States, were waiting for me to get the thing done. Ben Fishman, the Libya staffer on the NSC who had been close to Ambassador Stevens, came by to ask that we add something to the remarks about how much Stevens meant to young people across the government. Fishman looked like hell. Obama ended up giving the statement a little before 11, with Clinton by his side. He condemned the outrageous and shocking attack and pledged to bring to justice the killers who attacked our people. He echoed Hillary's words from the night before. There is absolutely no justification to this type of senseless violence. None. He paid tribute to Stevens, noting that he was a role model to all who worked for him. Then, in the type of language we'd always include after a terrorist attack, he said, "No acts of terror will ever shake the resolve of this great nation." After the statement, he lingered in the area outside the Oval Office, where a bank of television screens showed the different cable television networks responding to what he'd said. He watched for a minute or so while the commentators focused on what Romney had said the night before. "That should be disqualifying," he said, shaking his head. The rest of the week, protests over the offensive video continued to grow in dozens of cities around the world, from Islamabad to Sana'a to Tunis. The overwhelming fear was that Friday would be a bloodbath, Fridays being the biggest protest days in Muslim communities, as it's the weekend and people attend Friday prayers, where imams can stir up a crowd and extremists can take advantage of the chaos. A crisis response team started meeting regularly about what we could do to mitigate the situation. We reached out to all alumni of U.S. exchange programs in the Middle East, hoping to draw from whatever reservoir of goodwill had been built up. We contacted Google and YouTube to try to get the offensive video taken down. We disseminated talking points condemning the denigration of Islam in the video, while affirming that there is never any justification for violence. While we were doing this, other parts of the government were ramping up security at embassies, consulates, and military facilities across the Arab world. At home, the right-wing outrage about our criticism of the internet video continued to build as Republicans worked hard to make Benghazi into a political problem for Obama. It was as though I was inhabiting two entirely different worlds. I'd spent most of my day trying to convey messages to people outside the United States who were offended by the video. Then I'd spend an hour or two helping Jay Carney prepare for questions about whether we were apologizing for the video or whether Obama's foreign policy was a failure. When I focused on the audience outside the United States, I opened myself up to criticism for being tone-deaf, politically correct. When I focused on figuring out how to respond to Republican critics, I opened myself up to criticism for being political. It was like dealing with mirror images of insanity. One night that week, as I walked out of work, I saw a candlelight vigil taking place in front of the White House. I recognized a few of the people, Libyan Americans I'd met with at the White House when we intervened to save Benghazi. They were honoring the memory of Chris Stevens. A small circle formed around me. One of them had tears in his eyes, thanking me for the role I'd played in supporting President Obama's intervention in Libya, and saying that he feared for the future of the people there. "Do you think this means the United States will have to leave Benghazi?" he asked. "I hope not," I said. But I knew that it did. On Friday, every time I walked into my office and saw the television playing another video of protest, I felt a sense of chaos, as though something was unraveling that could never be reassembled. A steady stream of reports was delivered to my office detailing how American diplomats in different places were being told to shelter in place. 10,000 people protesting in Khartoum. In Lebanon, young men set fire to American fast food restaurants. In Tunis, four people were killed at the U.S. Embassy when an angry mob climbed the walls and raised a black flag. In Cairo, hundreds were arrested in Tahrir Square. In Afghanistan, the Taliban launched an attack that killed two Marines. Meanwhile, the caskets of the four Americans killed in Benghazi were returned to Andrews Air Force Base. I felt I was watching the Arab Spring turn dark in real time. That afternoon, I got called up to the press secretary's office. Jen Palmieri, the White House communications director, was sitting with a handful of staff. They looked at me a little sheepishly. "We need someone out on the shows," Jen said. All five Sunday shows were asking. "Really?" I asked. She knew I thought those shows were a Washington ritual that accomplished little for us other than ruining people's weekends. None of our national security principals liked to do them, but she made a credible argument. "The world is on fire," she said, gesturing up at the images on television. She thought we needed someone to convey that we were on top of it. Also, Netanyahu was going to be on, and he was surely going to take shots at Obama. It'd be useful to have someone ready with a response. "Do you mind reaching out to Hillary?" she asked. I emailed Philippe Reines, Clinton's communications advisor, and asked if she'd be up for doing the shows. I got no response. Next, I asked Tom Donilon. He looked at me as if I were crazy. The only person left was Susan Rice. She was a diplomat. She could pay tribute to the people lost and in danger, talk about our approach in the Middle East, and respond to whatever Netanyahu said about our Iran policy. I had an initial conversation in which Susan